My castaway this week is an actor, a shy, rather solitary boy from a remote part of Northumbria. The theatre was said to be in the family genes, but lacking encouragement to head for the professional stage, he trained as an accountant. A year before qualifying, he quit, enrolled at drama school instead, and paid for himself by busking at Oxford Circus. It was a bold but inspired decision. After a long apprenticeship in rep, 10 years ago, he began to make his name in television. First as Neville, the carpenter who missed his missus in Auf Wiedersehen, Pet. 3 years later as the dependable Sergeant Lewis to John Thor's Morse. And in the 90s as the dynamic Dr. Jack Carouche in Peak Practice, three of the most successful series in recent television history. Acting is a refuge from reality, he says, and it's also a therapy for being shy. He is Kevin Whateley. So you hide, do you, Kevin, behind the characters you inhabit?
I think I do. I do it less now than I used to. When I was younger, I didn't have any time for my own character at all, and the acting was a sort of release for me.
So does that mean, as a shy person, which you say you are, you enjoy playing more dynamic roles because you sort of try being somebody you're not really?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I'm not lacking in energy. I do put a lot of energy into my work, but I'm a fairly laid-back, easy person, and I like playing more dynamic characters.
But on the other hand, presumably you play a role better if there are points of contact between you and the kind of guy you're playing.
Yeah, I don't think particularly on screen that you can play a character unless you find the points of contact and pull the character towards you rather than the other way. It's if an actor seems to be working too hard, it doesn't quite work. I don't think the audiences relax if they can see you working too hard at it.
So what were your points of contact in Trip Trap when you played a wife beater?
You've got me in one there. I'm not sure. I decided that I didn't understand any of the physical side of actually brutalising somebody physically. But the more I thought about the character, I thought, well, I can be quite rough in an argument, verbally quite violent. And I just took that and amplified it as much as I could.
But of the two characters we really know you for, and they're, of course, Sergeant Lewis with the short back and sides, very solid and conventional, and the rather more exciting Dr. Carouche, which are you, then? Which is more like you?
I've got a horrible suspicion, probably Lewis, but...
Why do you say horrible suspicion?
Well, he's a bit plodding, and there are large elements of both.
But which one do you prefer playing, I suppose, is a great test?
Carouche, I guess, yeah, because he gets on and does things, which I do.
Got a bit more about him.
Yeah, I would say so.
Tell me about your first record.
This is Ralph McTell. It's called An Irish Blessing, and I've loved McTell stuff for years. I think he's our best singer-songwriter. For 25 years I've listened to his stuff, and I find his songs always have something relevant to say, and this is about letting your children make their own mistakes. My daughter at the moment's singing Ralph McTell songs in her chamber choir, so she was very keen for a Ralph McTell track as well. And I owe him a fortune in royalties for one reason or another.
Now it's me who has to learn to let you make your way alone. Try not to direct each turn, your triumphs and mistakes you roam. Your path will differ and be to mine. Tricks of my trade, no use to you.
Ralph McTell and An Irish Blessing. So you owe him, you say, because you used his stuff in your repertoire as a busker, presumably.
I did, without his permission, several of his songs, yeah.
But were you a successful busker?
Yeah, financially. I'm not sure that London Transport thought I was. They arrested me more than once. But it was a necessity. I paid my way through drama school.
Why arrested you, though? Where were you? What was illegal?
I used to sing in the Oxford Street Underground station, Oxford Circus, usually during rush hour on a Friday morning, and it was illegal. There's a bylaw that says you can't sing there.
How much would you have made on a Friday morning?
Well, we're talking about the early 70s, 10 or 15 pounds in an hour, maybe.
Not bad, is it?
It was great.
Did you seriously consider making a living out of singing?
I think at the time, you know, there was nothing else. I didn't want to go to university, and I wasn't sure where I was going.
Because you've got the usual pack of sort of GCSEs and A-levels, haven't you?
Yeah, that was fine. I was quite bright, but I knew I didn't want to go to university. I didn't want to carry on learning.
But eventually you went to see a careers officer because you thought you better get real.
That's right. I went to see the careers advisory guy in Newcastle, and He said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to be an actor. And he said, oh, there's no future in that. No, no, no. I don't think he knew anything about it, to be fair to him, or how to get me started in it. And he said, what else do you want to do? And foolishly, I said, I'd like to be a big business tycoon, not really knowing what it entailed. And he said, oh, right, accountancy is the thing for you. And within 3 days, I was organised, put articles with Pricewaterhouse in Newcastle, and that was it for the next 3.5 years.
Stuff. I mean, big firm.
Big firm and huge accounts. I mean, it was fascinating. I've never regretted doing it. We used to do stock takes at ICI and British shipbuilders there, Swan Hunters, and little wood yards and Scottish and Newcastle breweries. So I saw a huge area of working life.
And you did that for a couple of years at least?
3.5.
3.5
yeah.
Years. So it was a huge decision when one day you decided, this is not for me, I'm still going to be an actor.
It didn't feel like a big decision at all.
But was there a catalyst? What happened?
Yeah, I joined the People's Theatre in Newcastle, which is a big co-op theatre with about 1,000 members. Would do about 6 plays a year there, or maybe more, one every 6 weeks. And I realised I was living for the evenings and that the work in the day didn't mean anything to me at all.
Has there been a time since, or was there, you know, in the years that followed immediately after that, that you thought, I should never have done this. I could now be earning a good, solid, if not lucrative, living as an accountant.
Not for a second. There's nothing else I've ever wanted to do, really, realistically.
Record number two.
Record number two is Smetana's the Moldau. I love Prague as a city. I think it's beautiful and it's just a stunning piece of music. It was around when I was a kid. I think my mum had an EP of the Moldau, bit of Mavlast, and I used to play it at home.
Part of Smetana's Mavlast, played by the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Jiří Bajalislavik. Just to go back a bit earlier, Kevin, I said that the theatre was in the family genes. It goes back to your grandmother, doesn't it?
She sang at concert parties and things, I think, but I never knew her. But what we did have of hers was a big tin of stage makeup grease paint, which fascinated us as little kids. My sister had a fantastic facility, my elder sister Alison, for writing plays. She'd invent a ceremony for any occasion and march us around the garden or up through the village, and we were always clagged with this grease paint and dressed in bits of old curtain. And
so it was a little village, was it? I mean, I said remote part of Northumbria.
Yeah, it's just above the Roman wall. It's a place called Humshaf, and it's on the North Tyne River.
And your father was interested in the theatre as well?
He was. He was in the Royal Navy. And I never saw any of his productions, but he used to direct at one point. He was an instructor commander at Greenwich, and he used to put plays on there. I never actually worked with him or had any theatrical discussions with him, really, that I remember. He died when I was 17.
Did he?
Mm-hmm.
What? Very suddenly?
Fairly suddenly, of a heart attack, but he'd had two before. It was his third one.
And he'd been away in the Navy anyway, so you perhaps didn't know him very well.
I think I was just getting to know him. Well, at the time he died, he came out of the Navy when I was 11. But by then I was away at school. And I didn't have a lot of time with him, unfortunately.
Hmm. So did it come as a great blow when he died?
Huge blow. Absolutely huge. Yeah, I thought the world of him. He's a lovely man. And I'm not sure I've ever got over it.
So there were four of you. You were the second youngest, weren't you, of the brothers and sisters. Why does one get, when reading interviews about you, the impression that you were actually rather a lonely little boy?
I don't remember being lonely. I was a loner because it was very rural. I've always loved the outdoors, and we had dogs of various sorts. That was always my favourite pastime, just yomping off with a dog somewhere down by the river.
And why so shy if you, you know, spent your life performing?
I don't know why I was shy. I don't know why are people shy.
but why do you want to perform if you're shy is really the question, isn't it?
I suppose nobody likes being shy, not being able to cope in social situations.
But that's where the therapy comes in. It's helped you with your shyness. And you were saying earlier, you're not as shy these days.
I'm not nearly as shy as I was, no.
Yeah, you've learned to live up to your reputation.
Mm.
Next record.
This was a record that my dad gave me, I guess, when I was about 10 or 11, by Owen Branigan, who was a wonderful opera singer, but he recorded a lot of North Country folk songs. And I loved the northern variety songs, George Armstrong stuff. I found them very funny, and people used to laugh. I learned them and sang them as well. And that's one of the early things that got me hooked on performing. This is Cushy Butterfield.
I'm a broken-hearted keelman, what's our heed in low? With the young lass from Gateshead in a Calhameed go. Oh, her name's Cushy Butterfield, and she sells yellow clay. And her cousin's a muck man, and they call him Tom Gray. She's a big lass and a bonny lass, and she likes her beer. And they call her Cushy Butterfield, and I wish she were still.
Owen Branigan and Cushy Butterfield. You'd have been in your mid-20s then, Kevin Whateley, by the time you got your equity card and the long slog in rep began. What sort of things did you do? What were the high spots or the low spots?
It never felt like a slog, and I don't remember any low spots at all, but I was very lucky. A lady called Joan Knight came down from Perth while I was at drama school and directed a show there and took me up to Perth, and I guess the first year I did about 13 or 14 shows, plays, and she used to mother me through and say, what would you like to play in the next one, and I'll tell you what I think you should play, and you tell me what you'd like to play, and we'll come to some agreement. And it was great. I was the resident Englishman in a Scots company, so I got to play princes and all sorts.
And you did panto as well, did you?
Panto, yeah, panto every year, and at least one Shakespeare every year.
Marvellous experience.
Fantastic start. Great.
Mm. And then you went into left-wing theatre.
I did, yeah. I did 5 or 6 years around the Reps, Stoke, the theatre in the round there. And at the time, there was a very thriving left-wing theatre, 784, and a group called Pirate Jenny that I used to work for, a lot of feminist group. And we did one-night fit-ups all around the country. It was like being in an old Shakespearean touring group. I loved it.
But then suddenly, in 1983, when you'd have been, what, about 32, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Along came Auf Wiedersehen, Pet, about a group of Geordie builders who go to work in Germany, and you were asked to be Neville the Carpenter, the Drippy Chippy, mm-hmm. as somebody called him. Did you know right away that that was a part for you?
All the Geordie Mafia knew about the scripts, Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenet's scripts, and we all wanted to be in them, and we all wanted to play Oz.
Because they'd written The Likely Lads, of course.
They'd written The Likely Lads, yeah, and Porridge, and the supreme comedy writers. And these scripts, you knew as soon as you read them that they were something special. I realised, although I'd like to have played Oz, that I just wasn't an Oz.
That was Jimmy Nail.
That was Jimmy Nail's character, and Neville was obviously the part to go for. So.
Mm. But did you also recognise that this was perhaps a defining moment in your career, or was it just another job?
We had no idea because we were all pretty inexperienced and ill-disciplined, and for us it was just like a party or the first series, and it came as a bit of surprise when it did take off as big as it did.
Because audiences of 18 million in the end.
Yeah, extraordinary. It actually topped Coronation Street for a week or two at one point. It was a huge success. It was like being in a rock band. It was a very strange reception. We all felt like we were a lump of people, the lads, and weird experience.
Record number 4.
This is Joan Armatrading, who again I think is a wonderful singer-songwriter, and this is a record that we were listening to a lot, Madeline and I, when our first child was born, Kitty, and it means a lot to us for that reason.
We all make mistakes, and I'm no exception. Sometimes I think I've told it all so lately, but there's no one there to hear the words I say. Sometimes it all sounds so crazy.
Joan Armatrading and Everybody Gotta Know. So then along came Morse. It was 1986, 10 years ago. So the idea of a two-hour format must have been very new.
It was, and I don't think anybody was too sure how it would work out.
It makes it much more of a sort of television event, an occasion,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, and it was fab for us because it meant you could develop the characters over 2 hours, and the writers had a ball. I mean, obviously 2 hours is much more difficult to write than a half hour or 1 hour thing.
But it makes it much less predictable,
sure,
you know, for the viewer, really, because otherwise it slots into a kind of formula, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, it seems an obvious thing to do for those whodunits, but at the time, it was quite a big risk, and Central took it.
What does it mean for the actor, though? I mean, obviously, it's a much longer shoot.
It's 25 days for Morse, which is generous nowadays. Peak practice was 11 days for an hour. It meant that we could gradually evolve the characters.
But nevertheless, long hours of sitting around waiting for the next shot to be set up.
We once worked out we'd do about 14 minutes of actual acting during a filming day, and the other 9 hours or whatever just sitting around waiting while the technicians set up.
So what did you do, you and John Thor, during all that waiting time?
We just sit and grumble to each other, and John talks about music a lot, and he's a fund of stories and stuff, and the time passes very amicably. It's great.
Now, your Sergeant Lewis was of course quite different from the one originally conceived by his creator, Colin Dexter, who had him, I think, as a middle-aged Welsh grandfather.
Yeah.
Couldn't have been more different, really. Was that anything to do with you, or...?
Possibly very slightly. Kenny McBain thought that wouldn't quite work, Morse and a grandfather figure. And with Anthony Minghella, they developed the Lewis character as much younger, and Kenny McBain had me in mind for Lewis.
But you mentioned earlier on that he was perhaps, Lewis, not the most interesting of characters. I mean, how did you deal with that? Because you couldn't make him assertive, but you were always there and obviously shooting lots of cutaways and so on, where you got to show something in your face, and yet it's a nothing as well.
I just found I was always in the back of Morse's shots with nothing to say early on, and Peter Hammond, one of the early directors, said to me one day, said, think of Steve McQueen. When you cut away to Steve McQueen, he's not saying, he's always doing something. He said, so do something for me. When I cut to you, I've got something there. So he got me thinking about that, really, and I started pulling faces in the background. And
pretending to be Steve McQueen?
No, now we know
the secret of Sergeant Lewis. You've done 29 of them, these Morses, 2 hours apiece. They've sold in 50 countries. Great hit in the States. You've just done another one, which is... what is the form, then, that you'll go back from time to time and do an odd one?
Yeah, we won't ever do chunks, lumps of the films again, but Colin is still writing the books, and we do enjoy doing them, and obviously they sell very well around the world, so from time to time, when we're both available, if one of the books would make a good film, we'd do it.
So there's one more coming up to look forward to. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you did it fairly intensively for 6 or 7 years, this scene you've just described in the trailer with John Thor. You obviously got on well with him, but it was presumably time you did something on your own. It's a long time to play second fiddle to somebody, isn't it?
That's never bothered me. It never feels like second fiddle. I'm always slightly mistrustful of star vehicles. It's something I've tried to avoid.
You haven't avoided it very successfully, because Peak Practice was about to come next.
Yeah, but it wasn't. I don't think it was, a star vehicle, although it was written for me. There were 4 or 5 good big leads in it, and it worked for that reason, I think.
We'll talk about that in a minute, but let's have record number 5.
I've always loved Elian Pipe music. It makes my hair stand on end, and this particular one, Midnight Walker, for some reason, which I've never known why, always makes me think of my dad.
Davy Spillan and Midnight Walker. And then in 1993, Kevin Whateley, along came Jack Karrueche and Peak Practice, quite a star vehicle for you. How nervous were you that it might flop? Because, of course, John Thor popular though he is, had just missed the mark with A Year in Provence, hadn't he?
Yeah, it's very nerve-wracking to be put in that situation. You are more aware that the actors do take the flak if it flops, and equally the plaudits if it succeeds.
So do you remember the night that peak practice went out, the first one, and you sort of...
I do. I crouched at home behind the sofa and waited to hear what the overnights were.
That's the viewing figures.
Yeah, and was very relieved when they were good. So. Mm.
Why do you think it was such a success? I mean, again, audiences in their millions, 14 million, I think, 15 million for peak practice. What was the trick, in your view?
For me, it's almost always the writing that it starts with, and Lucy Gannon's writing was great. She's got a real talent for inventing characters that interest people. And the situation is bound to appeal. Again, you've got beautiful scenery, doctors meeting people in extremis, so a good opportunity for drama.
But when they decided that they wanted to run it twice a week, you balked. Now, surely it was a very good idea. I mean, there was a point at which the BBC wanted to do that with Casualty. You've got a ready-made audience, good characters, endless plot because you've got these medical problems, as you say. Why did you object to it so much? Why did you refuse?
It's difficult to know. Obviously, TV executives know more what the audience wants than we do. But I thought where The Bill had done that, gone into twice weekly, they're set in London, they've got 7 million potential there. Protagonists to take from. We were in a tiny village, and I just thought they might exhaust the stories pretty fast.
Mm. So you said goodbye to Jack Carouche. Were you sad to do so?
Yeah, after 3 years, I'd had enough of him, and so he jetted off to Africa or wherever he went.
And that was when you turned to wife-beating. That was Lucy Gannon writing as well, again.
This was Lucy again, yeah. She came to me, I think, in the last week that we were shooting on Peak Practice and produced this script from a handbag and said, have a read of that when you've got a minute. And I read the first 10 pages almost immediately as soon as she'd gone out of the caravan. And it made my hair stand on end. I felt sick and I thought, oh, Lord, what am I going to say to Lucy? This is too violent for me. And
because we should explain, you were a primary school headmaster who beat up
his wife,
really.
Took out all his frustration on her. And I went away and thought about it and read it again and a fortnight later and realised what a good piece it was.
But how did you do it? Because it did actually look as if you were hitting her.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't, obviously. Stella Gonane and I had both done a lot of stage fighting. I used to direct stage fights 20-odd years ago, and it's all camera tricks. But obviously the intention's got to look right, as if you hate this person for whatever reason and mean to do them damage, which isn't very pleasant to do, but it's a job.
But it was a difficult job, and it was the first time I think we'd seen you, you know, on the small screen, playing a nasty guy. Was it a deliberate move of yours
not
to stop being Mr. Nice Guy?
No, not a bit. It was just that it was a great part, a good acting part, and a very special script. I never even considered that. The press said that quite a lot, that it was a change of direction. But it didn't feel like, because he's a nasty character, doesn't make any difference to the way you approach him as an actor.
Next record.
This is Salif Keita. I could quite happily take 8 of his records. The island, it's Tekere. He's got a fantastic band of Africans from all over the continent. And I went to see a concert in Harare when I was filming out there and just had the best night of my life bopping to this. So this is, I'd take this and dance around the island.
Salif Keita and Tekere. Then, earlier this year, Kevin, you were on stage in the West End, 12 Angry Men, the story of the trial of a black teenager accused of murdering his father, set in 1950s New York, when to be black was to be automatically guilty. You were the liberal-minded juror who took on the other 11, the Henry Fonda role, directed by Harold Pinter. I mean, this was presumably rather different from Peak Practice.
It grabbed me immediately reading it, because you read it and you want to play all the parts as an actor. All 12 characters are fascinating. There are 12 stories going on there of people agonising about whether or not they can believe completely that this lad did it. I think it's a fabulous play. It was written by Reggie Rose when he was 25 or something, just after the McCarthy era. And it's very much of its time, but it had a lot to say about today as well.
But a completely different experience, the theatre. I mean, it's now or never. There's no hanging around. Do you prefer that? Do you prefer that immediacy?
12 Angry Men is particularly good because all 12 characters come on the stage and are locked in the room, and the play happens over 2 hours. There are no time cuts or anything. It's much easier as an acting exercise and much more concentrated.
More fulfilling?
Much more fulfilling, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
And are you, in a sense, exhausted by small screen fame, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm not sure about exhausted. It's not very pleasant. If you're private like me, it's very difficult to come to terms with everybody knowing you or thinking they know you. And obviously, you're part of their everyday life, so it's very difficult. But it's a side of it that I don't enjoy very much.
And so in an ideal world, professionally, I mean, you are hot property because of the millions that you can pull in television audiences. Would you still turn down any future offer if you had a better theatrical offer?
If I wanted to play the theatre part badly enough, that's what I would do.
It comes down to money, I suppose. I mean, you get more money for the television, don't you?
You get a lot more money for television, obviously, because it can be sold abroad and you can reach, in this country, 10 or 15 million people in one hit, where I probably only played to 50,000 people altogether in 6 months in 12 Angry Men. Money doesn't come into it a great lot. Not anymore, anyway.
You can choose a bit more these days.
Yeah.
But you prefer theatre?
Probably, yeah. As an acting exercise, definitely.
Record number 7.
This is another great singer-songwriter, Alan Hull, who unfortunately died last year, who I knew on the folk circuit in the 60s around Newcastle, and he formed Lindisfarne, and this is called Run for Home. I sang this with them. They had their 25th anniversary concert last summer, which makes me feel very old, and we sang this on stage with them.
Run for home.
Lindisfarne and Run for Home. How many children have you got, Kevin?
2. Kitty's 13 and Kieran's 11.
And your wife, Madeline, is an actress. In fact, she's appeared in Morse and in Peak Practice.
She has, hasn't she?
Is she your best critic?
Easily, yeah. I mean, she's the person whose opinion I trust most about my acting.
Does she tell you which parts to take and which to turn down?
On occasion, yeah. It was certainly her idea to go for Neville in Auf Wiedersehen, Pet.
Who was it? Mm-hmm. The one that began it all?
Mm-hmm.
But family apart, I suspect A Desert Island would be right up your street, wouldn't it?
It would, really, yeah. I have to say, I am very self-sufficient and I've always been very happy with my own company, so I don't think loneliness would be a problem. I don't think survival would be. It depends how long it would be for.
And boredom wouldn't be a problem?
I'm one of those terrible people that has to be doing something every minute of the day, and I'd find something to do, whether it was building a boat or trying to cook groundnuts or whatever it was.
So you quite fancy the idea. I mean, you would find peace of mind, would you?
Well, peace of mind, but I'd also like the challenge and the adventure. It's something, as you get more and more established, you get used to quite a cushy, soft life, and I would enjoy the challenge from that point of view as well. I like being out in the wilds. And being close to nature. It's something that really appeals to me.
Last record.
This is Sibelius's First Symphony. I hadn't listened to much. I'd obviously heard Sibelius, but I remembered John Thorne, Kenny McBain talking about him when we were having supper somewhere in Oxford very early on in Morse, and raving about him, saying, oh, he'd have been writing film scores if he was alive today. And I went and listened to him more closely, and he's become my favourite composer.
Thank you.
part of Sibelius Symphony No. 1 in E minor, played by the Finnish Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jukka-Pekka Saraste. If you could only take one of those 8 records, Kevin, which one is it?
It would be the Sibelius. If I'm stuck in a traffic jam or anywhere and I'm not feeling very happy, it lifts me straight away, so that would be it.
What about a book, as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
I wonder if I'd be allowed the Field Day Anthology of Irish Writing, which is vast and would take me about 4 years to get through. Is that a bit of a cheat?
It's a bit of a cheat, but if you can have it if you'll name a favourite author, favourite writer of one kind or another.
All right, but my actual favourite writer is Salman Rushdie, and the alternative, if I wasn't allowed the anthology, would be The Moor's Last Sigh, which has been sitting by my bed for a year waiting for me to get round to reading it. I'm looking forward to it enormously.
And what about a luxury?
I'm terribly torn between a large supply of my mother's marmalade. I suppose I wouldn't have any toast on a desert island, so I think I'd better take some Northumbrian pipes, probably, and wrestle with those without annoying the neighbours. I've always wanted to learn to play the pipes, and this could be the opportunity.
Kevin Whateley, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks, sir. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.